my mother's just crazy, that she comes from a crazy family, and that I'm going to turn out to be crazy too. Well, at least you won't be alone in your craziness, Jared said. I'll be crazy with you. I had a hard time looking at him, knowing what he'd sacrificed to come here with me, even though I told him not to. So I turned to look at the angel in the painting above the bed instead. He looks like you, Jared said a second later. I looked down to meet his eyes again. They were locked on me, hard, and I felt frozen beneath their gaze. Who? I said. He nodded up at the angel. You look like that, he said. You're beautiful like him. You love me too much, I said. I couldn't bear to think of someone seeing me in a way that I couldn't. It scares me sometimes how sure you are about me. There's no such thing as too much love, said Jared. He reached out to take my hand from my lap, but I pulled away. There is such a thing as too much love, I said. No one should give up everything for another person. I mean, it sounds nice. But what if missing practice to be here with me means you don't play first string this season? And because of that, college scouts don't get to see you play as often. What if all this loving sacrifice means you don't get a scholarship? And all because of my stupid family. Who says I want to go to college? Jared said, wrinkling his nose a little. He was trying to play it off like it was no big deal, but I knew different. He'd been trying hard in his classes the past few months, and he'd been working out rigorously to get ready for the season. You don't have to say anything for me to know you want to go to college, I told him. What? Said Jared. Are you reading my mind or something? I smiled and shook my head. No, I said. It's just a logical deduction. I know you're not in love with baseball. You do it because you're good at it, and it's a way to get things you want, like a scholarship. You're right, Jared said. I'm not in love with baseball. I'm in love with you. You're what I want. And baseball, I'm afraid, won't get you for me. He reached out again, and this time I let him take my hand in his. But why risk what you need for what you want? Who says you're not what I need? He said, sounding a little offended. There are plenty of ways to get by in life other than by playing baseball. I'd rather lose first string and a chance at a scholarship than lose you to whatever's happening here. You're happening here, I said. You're who started all this. I wouldn't have it any other way, Jared said, pulling me closer. Close enough for us to kiss. Which was what we started doing a second later. Softly at first, then harder, more hurried, as if someone might come in and try to stop us at any moment, and if we didn't get those kisses in right then, we never would. Beneath the painting of the angel, we twisted together, losing ourselves as we explored one another, protected, hidden beneath the canopy of his large, white wings. Chapter 14. In Plain Sight. We spent the rest of that first day talking with Carolyn, who continued to dote on us like you might expect any great-aunt figure to do. I couldn't get her to sit still, really, after Jared and I went back downstairs to join her. She made oatmeal cookies and talked to us over one shoulder the entire time, mostly talking about the daily life in Lilydale, which was quiet as could be at that time of the year, which she preferred. But the mediums, the young ones, they need the summer season to pay their bills, she added. When I asked if she was a medium too, she scrunched her face up as if she'd sucked on a lemon. No, no, I don't use my gifts that way. I just rent this old house's rooms out and serve tourists their breakfasts. After the cookies, it was lemonade. And after the lemonade, she took a quick nap before making dinner. By the time the day was over, she was exhausted from cooking and baking and talking, and said she would retire to her room, and suggested Jared and I go to sleep as well. Which we might have done if Jared hadn't appeared in my room moments after we went upstairs, asking if there was any room for him beneath the angel's wings. The next morning, we came down for breakfast. Carolyn's first question was, "Well, how was last night for you?" For a second, I thought she'd maybe heard Jared and me up in the room, and the red heat of embarrassment swept across my face like a grass fire. "I'm sorry?" I sputtered. I wasn't sure if I said it the way someone says excuse me when they bump into someone in passing, or the way someone says they're truly sorry for a great offense, but I hoped Carolyn would let my and Jared's possibly not-so-secret rendezvous go quietly. "Last night," she said again. "Did you feel it? The energy?" Jared covered his mouth with his hand and pretended to rub a non-existent goatee, but I kept as straight a face as possible. "I'm not sure," I said. "What kind of energy?" "The energies of Lilydale," said Carolyn. "Most people who spend a night in this town say they can feel the place reach out to them. Some say it brings them visions." "Oh," I said, and almost sighed with relief. "No, I didn't have any visions. I slept like a baby. No dreams, or at least none I can remember. And believe me, after the past 6 months or so, not dreaming was awesome." Carolyn nodded, then blinked, seeming a little disappointed by my answer. She tightened her silver top knot and said, "Well, we'll have to try harder then. Let's go for a walk." I got up, surprised she was actually hoping for me to have some kind of out-of-body experience, and as I stood, Jared said he'd stay behind. "I need to call my mom," he said, "so she doesn't call the police on us for going missing." I could tell that he really did plan to call his mom, but I also knew he was trying to give me time to be around Carolyn without him. Who knew what she might be holding back just because Jared, an unknown factor, was with us? So I agreed to leave him behind in the angel and fairy-infested house and went for a stroll with Carolyn down a gravel road that seemed to constantly curve around bends over and over, encircling the entire place, holding the village in sight. For 10 or 15 minutes we ambled along quietly, looking anywhere but at each other, until we came to a break in the tree line beside us. And there Carolyn turned to enter the woods. It wasn't a beaten path she led us down, like I expected, but a cement walkway that went straight up to a white one-story building with cornflower blue trim around its windows, and four pillars holding up an overhanging roof. On either side of the walkway stood rows of pots for flowers, which were just starting to push their way out of the soil. When Carolyn stopped in front of the building, she bowed her head and whispered something, then raised her head again and opened the front door. From the outside, the place looked a bit like the VFW hall back in Temperance, and I half expected to find a slew of old-timer veterans inside, sitting on folding chairs around cafeteria tables, arguing about politics and sharing their faded war stories. But what I found instead were rows and rows of blue-cushioned chairs, and at the back of the darkened room, an altar flanked by tall blue-glass lanterns. "Is this a church?" I whispered, immediately adopting the hushed tone sacred places inspire. And Carolyn turned her wrinkled face toward the ceiling, as if some kind of spiritual force roosted in the rafters. Slowly, she turned in a circle, then looked down at me again and shrugged. "We call it a temple," she said. "A place for healing. It's where your grandfather did much of his work. Right here within these walls." "My grandfather?" Carolyn nodded. "I don't know much about him," I said. "My mom never talks about him, other than to say she had a falling out with her family years ago. She doesn't even have any pictures of him around the house." "Who was he? What was he like?" Carolyn frowned at that and shook her head. Then she pinched her thumb and forefinger together and ran them across her lips like a zipper. I nodded. I understood that whatever story my mother had told, whatever spell she'd cast over so many of us, prevented Carolyn from giving me the answers I wanted. At least direct answers. Carolyn was taking in the place with a nostalgic gaze now, as if she'd been frozen in a cryogenic chamber for years and had only woken from her deep sleep upon my arrival the day before. I didn't get any of her good feelings about the place, though. The room was strange. spooky. Even if the grandfather I'd never met had done some kind of work in this place, I wanted to leave instead of lingering in the temple's weird blue shadows. "I can tell you a few things," Carolyn said when she eventually reached the altar. Her back was to me, so her voice was slightly muted. "The cracks in your mother's story continue to widen, allowing me to slip some things through. Things that won't disturb the story's essence." I bit the corner of my lip, then said, "What kind of things?" "Some say this is a holy place," Carolyn said, raising her hands, palms up, as if she were about to invoke a god. "Some say that the ties between this world and the one beyond it are stronger here. Your grandfather always said he could feel the energy he needed to heal people more when he came to this place."
"He was a healer?" I asked.
"He was," said Carolyn. She sounded proud of this fact, as if he'd been a judge or police officer, some authority figure out in normal society.
"Could he really heal people?" I asked.
"I saw him do it every summer," said Carolyn, nodding with the firmness of a true believer. "Right here in this room. I hear he sometimes did it in Temperance, too, for people he trusted to keep his secrets. But always here, every summer, people would come to him in the temple, and he would heal them."
"How could he do that?" I asked.
"Do you, as I suspect, know what it is to reach across to someone?"
I nodded and said, "I do."
"Well, it's like that," said Carolyn. "The same way you can see the thoughts inside someone if you reach across to them. Just like that, he could see inside people, could see what made them ill, and sometimes he could take their illness out of them."
"But how?"
"I don't know how, really," Carolyn said, turning to face me again. "I was never able to do that, you see. It's far beyond my abilities. But the way it looked, he'd touch them wherever they hurt, and would somehow pull the sickness toward his fingertips, like a magnet pulls metal. And when he had all of the illness in his hands, he'd jump back and walk it to the front door over there, and he'd scatter the sick on the wind. You could see it all go away. You could see it all fly off like ashes."
"Are you serious?"
Carolyn said, "Serious as a heart attack."
"Could he stop one of those, too?" I asked, thinking of my poor dad clutching his chest in his tree stand a few months earlier.
She shook her head. "Your grandfather always said that those are too quick. One of the things that happen too fast for a healer to catch hold of."
"Too quick," I repeated, grimacing at the bad luck I'd had to be born into a family like this one.
"Too quick," Carolyn repeated. "Too quick for him to save even his own wife when one took her."
"I wish you could tell me more," I said.
"I wish I could, too," said Carolyn. "But despite the cracks in your mother's story, it's still a strong one. Come on. There's another place I want to show you."
We left the temple and took up another path nearby. This one led us away from the cottage-lined streets into the thick forest surrounding them, where the trees towered high into the sky. They must have been 100 years old, at least. You didn't see much old-growth forests like this outside of protected areas any longer, and being inside here, beneath such grand old trees, made me feel small and more like any other human being, which was a comfort. The path led us deep into the woods, until suddenly we entered a shaded grove where rows of park benches surrounded an old stump. A stump that was so wide and flat on top, it looked like it served as a platform for people to stand on, to speak from.
"What is this place?" I asked. "Inspiration Stump," said Carolyn, smiling. "When people come to Lilydale for the summer, these benches will all be full, and the mediums will take turns standing in front of the stump to give messages to the visitors. We used to stand on the stump itself, but over the years it was being damaged by the constant wear, so we put that little ornamental fence around it, see?
and now we stand in front of the stump to draw on its energy. It's a sacred place. You can see more clearly from it. You can hear better because of it. You can feel more than usual.
What do you mean?
Go ahead, she said. Why don't you see for yourself? I looked back and forth between Carolyn and the stump, cautiously considering whether I wanted any of those things to happen. I was already too open to the things of the invisible world. They already wandered into my line of sight at random moments, flickering to life like optical illusions, whispering in my ears at night. Why would I want to open myself up even further to their communications? In the end, though, I knew Carolyn was trying to give me something she couldn't explain in words, so I moved toward the stump slowly and stood in front of the little wrought iron fence surrounding it. When I looked back, Carolyn had already taken a seat in one of the empty rows of benches, sitting with her hands clasped together on her lap. She nodded at me like a teacher might, encouraging me with a smile.
Actually, she said, I think you should do something we don't do in Lilydale any longer. I think you should get up on the stump.
On the stump? I echoed, raising my eyebrows as I looked at it. Carolyn nodded vigorously.
Yes, she said. The stump. No one has to know about it. It'll be between you, me, and the spirits.
I said, trying to be polite. Okay, maybe it'll inspire me. The thing had an aura of magic about it, sure, especially when Carolyn talked about it. But really, it was just an old stump in the middle of an old-growth forest. All the same, I lifted one leg over the fence, then the other, and went up a set of stairs, 1, 2, 3, stopping just before I stepped onto the surface of the stump itself. I stared at it for a moment. A slab of stone had been placed on top of it, smooth and gray. And as I stared down at that slab, a strong wind picked up and blew through the grove, moving the trees back and forth, rattling the new leaves as if spirits rustled through them, urging me to take the last step, urging me to let them help me. Wincing, worried that I might be electrocuted when my foot finally touched it, I took the last step onto the stump surface. And when I stood on top of the stone slab, I braced myself for whatever might come next. At first nothing happened, but after a minute the soles of my feet began to feel warm, as if I were standing on a heated floor. And the longer I stood there, the hotter they grew. Then the heat began to travel up the length of my body, inch by inch, moment by moment, until it reached my ankles, my shins, my knees. Then both of my legs seemed to catch fire. There was no real fire, though, just that faint heat, and then sparks flashing, until it looked like my legs were made of fire instead of flesh, two pillars of volcanic light, and I looked down, helpless, frightened. The fire continued to travel up my torso, my chest and my arms, my neck. Then I was drowning in flames, choking on fire. Light flared behind my eyes, opening up like a series of fireworks, the way it sometimes felt before one of my migraines. I wanted to jump off the stump, to avoid whatever was coming next, but I couldn't move no matter how hard I tried. I tried to scream, but when I finally forced my mouth open, another voice, the voice of the boy whose mother had died in the Living Death Tree back in Temperance. That boy's scream was the one to come out. Dobry Jablonski screamed. The old woman, his mother's friend Lisbeth, had already managed to pack his meager belongings. A wooden whistle his father had whittled for him, a shirt his mother had made for him. Now Lisbeth was sealing up the shack in which his family had existed together for several years after moving to Temperance, Ohio, where Dobry's father had said they would make a better life. They'd only been there a year before his father had begun to cough up blood, though, and within months Dobry and his mother had buried him. Dobry's mother, too, was now dead. Whether his eyes were open or closed, though, Dobry couldn't help but still see her hanging in the tree where she had died for him. Even now, days after she'd been buried,
When he went near the Lockwood orchard, he could see his mother's ghost in the tree.
"You must stop this right now,"
Lisbeth said as she shook him by his narrow shoulders. The boy had begun to scream when she removed a portrait of his parents from the wall.
"You have already said something terrible, done something terrible, something that you cannot take back. If you cannot control yourself, you will do so again without thinking. How many people do you want to hurt?"
Dobry didn't know what she was talking about, though.
"To name a thing," Lisbeth told him, "brings the thing into your possession, under your control. But a great responsibility is undertaken when you do this. To be a master of something, or someone," she added in a dark tone, "means you are bound to them as much as they are bound to you. You did not think of this when you made your curse, did you?"
Lisbeth shook her head, disgusted, and left him standing there as she moved to bar the windows with planks of wood.
"No,"
she muttered as she put a sense of order to the shack Dobry's father had built, wiping the last crumbs from the table so that vermin did not invade.
"No, how could you think of this? You do not know better. Your mother did not teach you this part. Your mother, she is shaking her head in heaven right now, regretting what she did not tell you. Now, though, you will learn from Lisbeth, and from others like us."
Lisbeth stopped to look around the room one last time, and to tuck a few strands of sweaty gray hair back under her babushka.
"My mother is not in heaven!"
Dobry shouted. She was still on earth, still caught in the tangled branches of the apple tree where she had died for him. Lisbeth folded her hands in front of her stomach and said,
"This too is because of you now, isn't it?"
And Dobry began to scream louder and louder, as if his voice could shatter every word she'd said.
"Lisbeth is a red-faced hag,"
Dobry thought as the old woman loaded him into a car she had borrowed to complete her final duties to Dobry's mother. I followed them, claiming the back seat quietly, hoping the boy and the woman wouldn't notice my presence inserted into their lives from the future, a watcher brought there by way of an ancient tree stump in Lilydale, New York. They were seers too, after all. When Lisbeth climbed into the driver's seat, she turned the ignition over and over, but the engine whinnied as if it would never start. And then finally, it roared to life, making the vehicle shudder. Dobry watched the woman from the corner of his eye as she looked ahead at the rutted roads, driving them toward Warren, the city where Lockwood had promised to put Dobry in jail for stealing apples. Her face looked like melted wax. It dripped with age, the skin pooling in various places, under her eyes, beneath her jawline. Lisbeth had been his mother's best and first friend in Temperance. She had appeared on their doorstep only days after their arrival in that little scratch-in-the-earth place, bearing gifts of thread and yarn for his mother, and a basket of food that would last them several days. Dobry could remember how his mother hadn't acted surprised by Lisbeth's sudden appearance, could remember how Lisbeth had told his mother, "Welcome, fellow traveler," and how his mother had smiled and said she'd worried there wouldn't be others like her where they were going. Dobry thought his mother had meant she'd feared there would be no Poles in Temperance, but while Lisbeth did share the kinship of their homeland, it was something else his mother had referred to. He could see that now. Too late, as always. At 10 years old, Dobry learned what his mother had been talking about. That was when his father, after dying, began to come to him in his dreams, and sometimes even in Dobry's waking hours, when his eyes were wide open. His mother had told him the truth then, when it was clear that he was like her.
"You are a lucky one,"
she'd said. And Dobry had said,
"What's a lucky one?" "Someone who sees,"
she told him.
"Everyone but the blind can see,"
Dobry countered. His mother had shaken her head slowly, her gaze steady. She put a finger to the side of his face, near his left eye, tapped it gently on the thin bone of his temple.
"No," she said. "I am not speaking of sight. I am speaking of visions.
Not everyone sees what you see. Not everyone sees what you will come to see in your lifetime, child.
In Warren, Lisbeth took Dobry to the train station, and they boarded the line to Erie, Pennsylvania, where an hour later they transferred to go on to Jamestown, New York. Dobry felt anxiety flutter within his stomach like a caged bird after they stepped down to the platform there, in a much bigger city than he'd ever been to. He looked around at the bustling station and asked, "Where are we going? Where are you taking me?" Lisbeth held one hand over his head, as if she might lower it to affectionately stroke his hair. After a moment, though, she thought better and took the hand away.
"You will see," she said. "Be patient."
Later that afternoon, she hired a driver to take them out of Jamestown, a city full of smoke and the noise of factories and the clamor of cars and trains. It was more than Dobry could take in all at once. The fields of temperance were what he'd become accustomed to. But the streets of Jamestown soon fell away from the car windows, and after a while Dobry looked back to find the city buildings jutting up like the peaks of lean black mountains in the distance. He didn't see me there behind him, looking over his shoulder. He pinched his lower lip between his teeth for just an instant, then looked back at the road in front of him. Ahead, the road wound and dipped as the car traced the outline of a lake. Surrounded by trees, Dobry couldn't see anything but a flurry of leaves float past, and the clouds of dust that formed in the road behind the car, sparkling like molten gold whenever a beam of sunlight passed through them. Later, after falling asleep against Lisbeth's side, Dobry blinked awake as the car pulled into a gravel drive that curved around the front of a 3-story hotel. An inn with its shutters still open, the eyes of the house staring as they approached. The hotel had a wide front porch held up by white pillars, and in all of the windows the shades were half-drawn. The land around the building looked like it belonged in a park, manicured to perfection, and the tall trees cast the perfect shade against the inn's white walls. People sat along the wide wraparound porch at small tables, drinking glasses of iced tea, wearing formal clothes, boaters and bow ties, the newest fashions. A man standing on the front porch took a watch from his jacket pocket to examine the hour. He twisted his mustache, clicked the lid shut, and slipped the watch back into his pocket. It reminded Dobry of the silver pocket watch Lockwood had given him. Out of guilt, Dobry assumed, for destroying his family. It sat in his pocket like an anchor now, mooring him to the day his mother had been killed.
"Where are we?" Dobry asked. "You are here in Lilydale," Lisbeth told him. "You will be at home here. And now your mother. Maybe she will come out of that tree and rest peacefully."
Lisbeth took Dobry into the hotel, where a room had been prepared for him. She instructed him to clean up while she attended to making a situation for him. He didn't understand what she meant by making a situation, but he did as he was told. The only alternative was to run away, and since his mother had trusted Lisbeth, Dobry decided he should trust her too, no matter what he thought of her melted face and oily gray hair. So he washed his face and behind his ears, as his mother had taught him to do. He changed the shirt he'd been wearing while they traveled for the only other one he had, the one his mother had made for him. He dusted his pants off, combed his hair with his fingers. It was curly and dark, and with a little water he could get it to look like a sea of black waves. When he looked in the mirror over the wash basin, he blinked. Beneath those dark waves, his eyes were green, flecked with gold. They were his mother's eyes. She had always said so. Other than the shirt she'd made for him, the one he'd changed into, those eyes were all he had left of her. Later, after Lisbeth returned and praised him for making himself ready, she led him from the hotel to a yellow house a few streets away. And as they walked down the dirt road to the house, Lisbeth said,
"This is where you will live now. The people here are good. If you are good to them, they will take care of you. Can you be good?"
Dobry looked up into Lisbeth's face, which was shadowed by her babushka. He nodded like a duty-bound soldier. There were introductions all around as Dobry met his new family. The father, Elias. The mother, May. The oldest daughter, Margaret, a girl with fiery red hair who was around Dobry's age. And then Carolyn, a small child who waved her hand and smiled when Lisbeth introduced Dobry. The first thing this sprightly creature said to Dobry, before anyone else had a chance to greet him, was,
"You're going to marry my sister. Did you know that?"
Everyone laughed at her announcement. Everyone except Margaret, the little girl's older sister, who blushed and turned her cheek into her lace-covered shoulder. Little Carolyn continued to chatter.
"And one day," she said, "we will be best friends, and I will help care for your children and your grandchildren."
Dobry narrowed his eyes at the little girl, her blonde coils and blue eyes, so like a doll he would find on the shelves of a store. She managed to make the entire room shift from cheerful to uncomfortable as she went on and on, divulging a future neither Dobry nor Margaret, apparently, had ever thought of, until the adults began to shush her. "Carolyn," her mother said, "it's rude to give messages when they haven't been asked for. Please contain yourself or go to your room." Carolyn bounced up and down on her heels.
"I can't contain myself," she said. "I don't want to."
She ran then up the staircase. A moment later, footsteps thudded in a straight line overhead as she ran down a hallway on the floor above. Dobry looked up, then back down at his new family, who were still smiling at him, still trying to make him feel welcome. Later, Lisbeth helped Dobry settle into his new room, where he sat on the corner of his new bed, looking at his hands in his lap, afraid to move.
"You will be fine," Lisbeth said. "You will learn who you are here. They will teach you since your mother is now unable. Do you understand my words?"
Dobry nodded, even though he didn't understand. I could see that in his eyes, two deep, frightened wells of insecurity. Lisbeth tried to smile fondly at him, then finally allowed her hand to rest on his head, to stroke his dark curls. She didn't say goodbye, but the next morning, when Dobry came down for breakfast, she was gone. And no one mentioned her except to say that Lisbeth would be back soon to visit. A sunburst filled my eyes then, sending out shards of light, shattering the vision, leaving me momentarily in a great, empty white space. Then the vision began to reshape itself to become a different time. Dobry was now a few years older, 16 or 17, with a dusting of hair on his chest and the face of a young man. He was staring into the mirror over his dresser, whispering at his own image.
"Who are you? Who are you?"
But the answer he received was always the same. Silence. In the silence, his worries and regrets were nourished. I watched as they grew in his mind like weeds overtaking a garden. He was always getting caught in them, entangled as in dreams. Getting caught in his worries and regrets always began with this question he posed in the mirror, then the hated silence. And in the silence, all of the memories that composed him would begin to shimmer and coalesce. The baskets of apples he used to hide at the edge of the orchard, where he'd retrieve them on his walk home from work. Mrs. Lockwood holding her little boy's hand, asking after Dobry's mother. Lockwood himself, that murderer. In Dobry's memory, the man holds a thick hand over his brow to shield his eyes from the sun, as Dobry's mother reaches out her hand, stretching to grasp the last apple from the orchard. She twists the stem and it drops into her open palm. There were other memories Dobry had made since then, with his new family, who were kind and good to him, as Lisbeth said they would be. But the memories that anchored him, the memories that became his idea of himself, were the ones that had occurred down in the orchard, on the spot of land people in Temperance had started to call Sorrow Acre since his mother's passing. He had said words that day, had hurled a curse at Lockwood without realizing it. The words had burst through his throat and found their way into the world, changing reality even as they entered it. At the time, Dobry hadn't realized what he was doing. How could he have understood the power he'd drawn on when his mother hadn't taught him that lesson? And would his mother have known how to teach him anyway? Was it something she was even able to do? His new parents, the Foresters, had roots in spiritualism. That was how they explained the source of Dobry's abilities, both to themselves and to Dobry. But even Mr. Forester once told Dobry, "You are capable of more than I can understand. To be honest, I am quite in awe of you." Lilydale was full of people with minor talents. The occasional spirit would whisper into their ears or lift the veil from their eyes to let them gaze at the world beyond for an instant. Dobry, though, was known for manifesting miracles. When he held a finger out, birds came to perch there. When he closed his eyes to reach across to someone, he could see what ailed a person, in mind or in body, and if he drew his fingertips over a person's skin, his fingers would twitch as they passed over the illness. And if he held his fingers over the illness for long enough, the tips would begin to jump, as if he were playing a piano, until sour-smelling beads of black sweat rose to the surface of the person's body, collecting on Dobry's fingers, eventually sagging from his hands like strings of dark sap. He'd take the sickness outside and throw it into the air then, where it would turn to ash and float away on the wind. He could go into another place, too. Another space, really. The backside of here and now was how he thought of it. The place where everyone in this world was sleepwalking. Everyone, that is, but him. He could do things there, could suggest things, could change things. When people awoke from their dreams in the morning, they tended to see things his way. "Who am I?" he asked himself in the mirror. The boy who had watched his mother die for him. That boy was gone. He was 16, then 18, then 20, married to his adopted sister Margaret, slipping a ring on her finger, kissing her in the center of the woods near Inspiration Stump, its energies thrumming around them, her coils of red hair lifting in the wind like flames. "A piece of good luck," Margaret's mother had told them. "Marry near the stump if you want your marriage to be a blessed one." He and Margaret had lived in close proximity for years already, and had slipped into loving one another with a certainty that eluded most young people, because they had been friends for so long. Only one thing seemed to escape them. Margaret couldn't carry a child. Each attempt ended in disappointment. So they lived alone, their hands intertwined before they fell asleep each night, thinking they would die this way, just the two of them, with no one to go on after them. With no one to carry their stories into the future. One night, though, Dobry remembered the way the words felt in his mouth when he was 12 years old, and so angry that reality began to waver as his words reshaped it. By now the curse he'd made that long-ago day had killed his enemy, he was sure. Although Dobry didn't know where or how it had happened, he knew that Lockwood was dead. He'd felt the string that attached them, that braided coil of sorrow and rage made on the day he'd cursed the man, snap when Lockwood drowned in his own reflection during the war in Europe. Lockwood's son would be next, according to the law Dobry had brought into being that day. And so on, and so on, and so on, the next, and the next, and the next, until they were all gone. The Lockwood family erased from existence. He could do that again, he thought now. He could bend the world to his will if he wanted the thing badly enough. But this time his wish would be made from the materials of disappointment instead of vengeance. He whispered words that night. "A child will come to us. A child will come through." And he doled the wish out little by little, encouraging it, nurturing it, giving it more and more power as he repeated it like a ritual every night thereafter. Until 8.5 months had passed, and Margaret was holding her hands over her ever-growing stomach, shouting with glee because her water had broken. The child was coming. The child Dobry had wished for every night for months and months was finally coming through to them. "Right now, Dobry!" she called from their bedroom, and Dobry rushed up the stairs to help her. At the top of the landing, though, he stopped. shocked, when he saw the blood staining her nightdress, the blood streaming down her legs, the way it kept coming. When the baby finally made its way into this world, Dobry set it aside and began to run his fingers across his wife's body, looking for the place inside her that bled so badly. But even as his fingers twitched upon locating the problem, Margaret's chest heaved violently, and then her body stopped moving altogether. Her heart had seized up. The beat had gone out of her. It flew from the room faster than Dobry could move to catch it. And even as the heartbeat disappeared like smoke on the wind, the child Dobry had wished into the world opened her mouth to send up a fierce howl. "Too fast to catch," Carolyn had told me. "One thing a healer can't mend, a heartbeat that's flown away from a person." The child, though, lived and grew. Her red infant face widened into the shape of a heart, like her mother's, and her hair grew in auburn. She was toddling, falling over, crying, picking up toys after she'd been scolded, a doll her Aunt Carolyn gave her for her birthday, a book of stories about fairies who live under the floorboards of children's rooms. Then she was striding across a field of clover, arms pumping as she found her pace, a smile blooming on her face. Now she sat at a school desk practicing her cursive, which was the best, the most finely modeled hand in class, her teacher told her. "Very good, Sophia," her teacher said. And the girl looked up, beaming with pride. "My Aunt Carolyn practices with me at home," she said. "That's why." Aunt Carolyn. There she was, bringing the girl, Sophia, my mother, a cup of warm milk in bed. "It'll help you sleep," she told my mother. "Don't worry. Your father will be back before you know it." "Where did he go?" Sophia asked. She was 10, her face still round with childhood, her hair just a little darker.
"He's gone back to the place where his own parents once lived."
"Where is that?" Sophia asked. She sipped the warm milk, scissoring her legs back and forth under the covers.
"Temperance,"
Carolyn said, running her hand across the coverlet, smoothing it down again.
"Where's Temperance?"
"In Ohio," Carolyn answered.
"What's he doing there?"
Sophia asked. Her words had started to come slowly with the onset of drowsiness.
"He's reclaiming your past," Carolyn told her. "He's making you a home there." "I don't want to live in Ohio," Sophia murmured. "I want to stay here with you."
She blinked, trying to stay asleep. But eventually, her eyes closed and her protests ended.
"It's not so different there," Carolyn replied. "Don't worry about it. You'll still spend your summers here with me, my love."
"I love you, Aunt Carolyn,"
Sophia murmured. The words barely escaped her lips before she drifted off to sleep. Carolyn tucked the comforter under my mother's chin, then went to the doorway, where she rested her hand on the light switch for a moment, looking over her shoulder at the sleeping child once more. Then, for just a moment, she turned toward the corner of the room where I stood in the shadows, invisible to them, I believed, like Scrooge being taken into his past, present, and future, watching in silence as everything transpired.
"Love you too," Carolyn said,
her eyes meeting mine for longer than a moment, it seemed, before she turned out the lights. When I opened my eyes, the fire that had consumed me was gone, but the wind still streamed through the trees, shifting the leaves against one another, whispering.
"What did you see?"
a voice called out, and I blinked, disoriented. The day had passed from late morning to early evening already, and somehow I'd stood there dreaming for hours. Carolyn stood from her bench in the grove, and I started to remember myself again, to remember where we were, to remember what Carolyn had brought me here for. "He was my grandfather," I said. "My mother's father, wasn't he? The boy who cursed us." Carolyn's long white hair had fallen out of its knot and now flowed over her shoulders like spilled milk. She nodded, frowning a little, sad to admit it.
He told me that eventually someone would see the truth and understand him, she said. He didn't mean for it all to happen as it has.
My mother?
Carolyn shook her head. How could your mother understand him? They did nothing but argue. She couldn't forgive her father for that. Not when she loved your father more than anything.
I don't know what you mean, I said.
Keep looking, Carolyn said, nodding at the stump beneath my feet. Keep seeing. She has told you things without telling you what they mean. She has hidden things from you in plain sight.
So there, on that old stump in the woods, I closed my eyes once more to see the pieces of my family's puzzle, the pieces my mother had hidden from me.
Chapter 15. Unraveling. When the vision took me this time, I found myself floating over a bed in a room that reminded me of the one I'd slept in the night before at Carolyn's house. Angels flew across the wallpaper. Fairy statues stood guard on bedside stands and windowsills. It was, in fact, Carolyn's house, but the person in the bed was my mother, who was stretched out on the comforter, staring up at the painting of the angel who pointed down. She was maybe 20 years old. Her hair spread across the pillow in long auburn curls like licks of flame rolling off her. She wore a summer dress, grass green, decorated with a bright print of sunflowers. One arm lay across her forehead, the other on her stomach, and her skin shone with sweat as she thought about the boy she'd left behind in Temperance, the boy she loved. I could see everything inside her, her thoughts, her memories, her feelings, bubbling and stirring. The boy who took up all of her thoughts and feelings, that boy was my father, John Lockwood, the handsome young man who, in her memory, seemed carved out of stone. Face chiseled, arms thick and ropey with muscle. The salt of the earth, she'd always called him. He was far away from her at the moment, back in Temperance, where she'd left him, and she wasn't sure what to do about him. She wasn't sure what to do about anything right then, really. In the next room over, a salt and pepper-haired man sat at a desk writing in a leather-bound journal. His hand scrolled across the page, leaving wispy black ink in the wake of his pen. He wore a short beard, neatly trimmed, black, with one stripe of gray down the center. Green eyes like his mother's. Green eyes like my mother's. Green eyes like mine. Suddenly, he set his pen down on the page and scraped his chair back to stand. Leaving the journal open on the desk, the pen collecting ink in a tiny bubble at its tip, he buttoned the top of his shirt as if he were going to a formal occasion, then left the room to cross the hallway, where he briefly hesitated before knocking on my mother's door. Knock, knock, knock.
"Who is it?" she asked softly.
"It's me," he said. "Will you please open the door, Sophia?"
My mom got up, but only opened the door a sliver, enough to see a fraction of his face.
"Daddy," she said, "we've been through all this already. There's nothing left to say."
She didn't look up into his eyes. Instead, she focused on a number of other items. The white button he had just slipped through its hole at the top of his shirt. The black hairs on the backs of his hands. The light switch panel beside the doorframe. She flicked it on, then off, then on again, like a restless spirit.
"There must be more to say," her father said. "I don't like it when there's bad blood between us. You know that. Your mother wouldn't have liked it either."
So, I thought after hearing that, my mom learned how to guilt me from a professional.
"Mama's dead, Daddy,"
my mother said.
"That doesn't matter. She wouldn't have liked it all the same."
"I don't like it either,"
my mother replied. But she still didn't look up at her father. She rubbed her forefinger and thumb together at her side, a gesture I'd seen her make all my life whenever she was anxious.
"Do you understand why I can't approve of this?"
her father asked through the sliver of space she'd opened for him. She nodded once, but she still wouldn't look at him.
"I don't think you do," he said. "I've told you the story, but you don't understand it."
"I understand," my mother said, her voice flat and heavy. "I saw what you did to his family." He nodded and said,
"Yes, but I'm not sure you understand why."
"I know what it means," my mom said, and finally she turned her face up to his. "I know what it means, and it's nothing to do with me and him. What happened years ago between you and that man isn't our problem."
"But it is," her father said. "And it's irrevocable."
"I don't see why you can't change it," my mother said, almost spitting the words at him. "If you made the curse, why can't you unmake it?"
"She won't let it go," her father said. "I told you, darling, she won't let go of it."
My mother's face turned red in an instant. "I'll make her let go," she said. "I promise I'll make her give up on it." Her father shook his head, though.
"There's no way to do that, Sophia. The only way to destroy it would be to make her leave."
"And to make her leave, someone has to leave with her," my mother mumbled. "I know. You've told me 1,000 times.
"Don't be like this,"
her father pleaded, his voice falling to a whisper.
"Don't tell me how to talk," my mother snapped at him.
Her voice rose as his fell, and she cringed because she could hear how she sounded like a child, and she couldn't stop herself from going even further.
"I'll talk how I talk, just like I walk how I walk. You can change so many things, Daddy, but you can't change that. You can't change that I love him."
"You have important work to do," her father said. "There are things I still need to teach you."
My mother looked over her shoulder into the shadows of her room, as if she knew I was in there with her, watching her, judging her. Then she turned back to her father, her face devoid of feeling.
"I don't think I want to learn any more," she said, quietly now. "I think I've learned enough from you, Daddy."
"Sweetheart,"
her father said. But my mother closed her eyes and shook her head.
"I'm done with all this," she said. "I just want to be left alone for a while. I just want to be normal."
"Some of us aren't meant for that," her father said.
From his vest pocket, then, he fished out a silver watch. The silver pocket watch my mother kept in her bedroom. The pocket watch I'd seen her hold when she entered the world's shadow, and when she sat at the dining room table with a lit candle, looking for my father's spirit, or else making changes to the story she'd bound us all up in. That pocket watch, silver and gleaming, was taken from my granddad's vest pocket and held out toward my mother.
"You're going to leave me," he said. "I can tell it."
"You don't know everything," my mother said sullenly.
"I know," he said. "I know more than you might understand."
"Here." He held out the pocket watch farther, the same watch his mother's murderer had given him, and forced it into her grasp.
"Be smarter than I've been," he warned her. "Save some time up for yourself and the ones you love." "I didn't know I could do that myself. I learned too late. If I'd known, I might have been able to save your mother. I might have been able to undo all the mistakes I've made."
"Daddy,"
my mom said, shaking her head, one tear slipping out of one eye.
"There will be 3 to come if you do this," her father said, gesturing toward her stomach. 3 that you won't be able to protect no matter how hard you try. They'll be like any of the others from that family. It won't matter that your blood is in them, because his blood will be there too. They'll all die early."
My mother didn't move. Not to nod, not to shake her head, not to speak. She was completely still in that moment.
"I can help," her father said then, "if you'd only let me. I could help relieve you of your burden."
"Do you mean the burden I saw in my dream?"
my mother said.
About what happened over in that orchard when you were a boy? Or do you mean the burden I carry? She looked up to meet his eyes then. They flickered down toward her stomach, accusing. That was his answer, that look. Her bottom lip trembled.
That would not be a relief, she replied firmly.
No, sir, that would not be a relief to me. Then she shut the door on him and locked it. She went over to her bed again, taking up the same position she'd been in before her father disturbed her. One arm flung over her forehead, one hand on the slight curve of her stomach.
There will be three to come,
she whispered to the angel in the portrait hanging above her. She caressed her stomach, ran her fingers in circles over its growing roundness.
So be it.
Later she stood and went to the dormer window, slid it up so that the night air drifted in and lifted her hair. She looked up at a star that seemed larger and brighter than any other in the sky, and recited the rhyme that she would teach me when I was little.
This is my home, and I know it. Even if I go away, it'll still be here. If I lose my way, it's your job to show it.
Then she reached out three times, as if to press the star with the tip of her finger, and it glimmered three times in return. A sliver of light no bigger than a blade of grass appeared before her. It was so small and narrow, she had to push the tips of her fingers inside to begin pulling at it, stretching it, making it bigger, until the outline of a doorway had taken shape in front of her, with bright white light pouring from it, filling up the room. She looked back at the door to her room once more, thinking about her father across the hall, what he'd said she should and shouldn't do. She thought about what she'd be giving up if she followed his plans for her. She thought about how the boy she'd left behind 2 months earlier had said he didn't care about what came before them. He didn't care what their families thought about who they should be or who they should be with. He said he didn't care about consequences. He loved her. That was all that mattered. Then he had leaned down and kissed her like it was the first time they'd ever kissed, 2 years earlier, right before they'd graduated from high school and were still trying to hold on to some part of themselves by holding on to each other. My mother turned back to the door of light in front of her, clutching the pocket watch her father had given her, and took a deep breath, then stepped through. And arrived on the other side, on a dusty back road lined with towering maples, where a yellow clapboard farmhouse stood behind the shade of those old silver branches, glowing beneath the moon. To the side of the house, across the creek, was an orchard with only a handful of apple trees still standing in it. The wind blew through them, and their apples shook loose, landing and rolling down the slope toward the glistening water of Sugar Creek. A young man, my father, stood on the stone porch of the house in his blue jeans and a thin white t-shirt. He was smoking a cigarette, something I'd never seen him do in my entire life. Startled by my mother's appearance in the middle of the road, he flicked the cigarette into a planter on the porch and raised his hand to wave at her.
"Sophia?" he said. "Where'd you come from? I thought you'd be in New York until August."
"It's not important," my mom said, not mentioning the way she'd gotten there. He knew she could do it, touch a star and it would open a doorway. But it made him uncomfortable these days, the older they grew. And he disliked the way people in Temperance sometimes talked about her and her father, knowing things other people didn't or couldn't possibly know. He was uncomfortable, too, she knew, because all of it reminded him of the thread of magic that ran through his own family, the way that thread bound them all together. He told her why.